This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. There appears to be a mixed bag at Cincinnati City Hall for local urban agriculture enthusiasts. A city panel gave the okay to make it easier for some aspects of urban farming, but the recently proposed city budget may make cuts to programs that support the activity. In spite of that, urban gardens continue to grow as residents make use of even the smallest of spaces to yield big rewards. One locally based author says all you need is a small yard and a commitment of just 15 minutes a day to yield an abundant harvest. It's the Monthly Gardening Show, a full hour with our panel of experts to help you through the issues and successes you're seeing with your own gardens and landscapes. So let's get started. Joining Cincinnati Edition today, our 10th acre farm owner and author of The Suburban Micro Farm, Modern Solutions for Busy People, Amy Strauss. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks for having me.
Director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Homeadow Song Farm, Peter Hottinger. Welcome, Peter.
Good afternoon.
And Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Extension Agent, David Kester. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
All right, 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you've got questions or comments about what's going on in your neck of the woods, your gardens, your landscapes. How do those trees look? What do your flowers look like? Are you having problems with some vegetables? Are there houseplants that are dying like I'm dealing with? Call us, 513-419-7100. We'll also take your questions via email at talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. So we'll start because we have a little bit of news to talk about. We don't usually do news on the urban or on the gardening show each month, but we have the Cincinnati Planning Commission, as reported by the Cincinnati Business Courier, voted unanimously on Friday to make it easier for residents and businesses to keep animals for farming purposes, to establish community gardens and compost, and some other agricultural issues. This is a growing trend that people in the city want to have traditionally farm animals on their property. What's driving this, guys?
Well, I think people want fresh, safe food. And I think that's one of the main things that is really kind of driving a lot of this. And plus, I think people are wanting to feel more connected to the land that feeds them. And so I think this having this connection with livestock is particularly of interest. Now, when we say livestock, primarily what people are keeping are chickens. There are maybe a few people with goats or sheep, but those are usually on larger parcels. But the big thing is the backyard chicken. And then some people are also raising meat rabbits.
One thing they're certainly not raising are roosters. You always hear at these meetings, like, how noisy are these things going to be? And the cities who are allowing this are usually saying that we're not going to have any roosters in the city. So they're not going to be waking you up at the crack of dawn. And you're saying that people are raising rabbits to eat.
Yes. I mean, that's a long tradition of that. Yes.
So what goes into that? How much space do you need? How many rabbits or too many rabbits? What's the right number to have?
Well, with rabbits, they're usually raised in hutches. And so the average hutch is probably, 36 by 36 by 48, or sometimes they're triple that length, depending on whether you're keeping a single rabbit or raising several. Some people have enclosures where they keep rabbits and chickens together. The rabbits are still in hutches, and that could be an area that's 200 to 300 square feet, or 100 square feet, depending on, the size of the yard and what they're doing. But people that are usually raising rabbits, for the most part, those are usually on larger parcels as opposed to our single lots that are usually around 35 feet by 125 feet.
You have to remember, if you're raising meat rabbits, you are going to have to be involved in the slaughtering as well.
Yeah.
And so that's something that a lot of people may think, well, gee, I'll just raise these. And you can. There are people that will do that. But for the most part, I would do some really heavy homework before I got involved in that, because not only do we want the rat, but we want them treated humanely and in the right size cages or dimensions and things like that. And it's not just something that you can gradually get into. Just do your homework before you decide to go that route.
You hear every Easter that please don't buy rabbits as gifts because they're problematic or a lot of work. But you were going to say something as well.
Oh, I was just going to sort of tack on to that with chickens as well. You know, we think chickens is sort of that backyard animal that anybody can grow some or keep some hens for eggs, but you do have to think about their end of life. They don't lay eggs forever, and what are you going to do with them when they stop laying? And so, you do have that question of how to manage their life. Yes. All the way to the end.
When you bring the country into the city, you bring every piece of the country into the city,
That's
I suppose.
Right.
So I don't even know if this is an appropriate question, but when it's time to slaughter a rabbit, what does that look like? What kind of work is that? Is it something simple? Do you have a shot you give them?
No.
Is it lethal injection?
It's usually cutting the throat
is
how it's done. And then they're bled out. And but cutting the throat is very quick. And then you skin and go for the meat from there.
You know, one thing I'd like to interject here is that I would say that of the people keeping livestock for personal use in the backyard, I would say that rabbits probably less than 1%. You know, that's anecdotal information. It's primarily chickens.
Chickens.
And what people are doing with chickens, I mean, the sad reality of chickens is they have a lot of predators. So often your laying hen doesn't – you'll either die of natural causes or of a predator will take place. But for people that when a chicken is no longer productive in terms of egg laying, there are facilities you can take and have it butchered. And often there are other people that, you know, if you don't want to butcher your own animals, you may have a friend that does. And people will pass it on to somebody that will take care of the chicken.
We're seeing these trends across the region, of course, in the city of Cincinnati and then in some cities in northern Kentucky, passing ordinances to allow the raising of chickens. Mm-hmm. But it was a mixed bag, apparently, at the Cincinnati City Building. Peter, you alerted us to the fact that the budgets proposed by both the city manager and the other one presented by Mayor John Cranley eliminate some funding for urban agriculture.
Yeah, there's a program called the Urban Agriculture Program that was administered through the Office of Environment and Sustainability. And there are some proposed changes in that program, which I think is unfortunate in terms of just the big picture of the city and sustainability and environmental issues by eliminating the director's position. I hope that the city council will rethink that. But there was a program, it was around $23,000 a year that were given out to different organizations and small market garden operations. To give them funding. And so I think the grant usually ranged anywhere from $500 to a couple thousand. But then in some cases, they also provided substantial funding around $5,000 to $6,000 to put in permanent water taps. And so, I mean, it's provided a really great base for a lot of organizations, but also it enabled enabled like the Turner Farm Community Garden Program to experiment with new technology. They funded us installing a solar-operated module that Joshua Jones, my coworker, can irrigate the garden down at the East End by using a cell phone. And this wasn't a very large grant, but it was just something that was tacked on, but it gave us the funds to experiment with this. And so now that we're talking to other people about it and other people are thinking of doing it, so it has a kind of a, you know, move forward kind of positive reaction. Also, we've done a lot of research in soil and soil remediation on urban sites, and we've been able to share that information with other people without these mini grants. And there's also some funding from Keep Cincinnati Beautiful, Safe and Clean grants. These are really critical to helping and create a thriving urban agricultural program in our city.
When people get upset at the city government, we often metaphorically talk about pitchforks coming to City Hall, but you guys are farmer types. Are actual pitchforks going to come to City Hall as you guys lobby for funding?
Maybe we'll bring some shovels and hoes. I think pruners.
Well, good luck with that. And Amy, you're here also because you've got this beautiful new book out. It's called The Suburban Micro Farm, Modern Solutions for Busy People. And I'm looking at the back here. You have a very interesting line on here that says, yield abundant harvest from your own yard with only 15 minutes a day. This sounds like one of those get fit in 20 minutes for 60 days. But you're saying that even if you're busy, even if you have a small space, you can have a nice plot of land.
It sounds pretty gimmicky, doesn't it? But you know what? When I wrote that, I was really thinking about the people who have always dreamed of having a garden, but they haven't gotten started because they have a sort of idea of how big it would be or how big it needs to be, how much time it would need to manage, they would need to manage it. And, you know, I really got down to working in a little tiny plot in my backyard. And I thought, you know, how can I make this manageable in 15 minutes a day? Because sometimes, you know, for those of us who are busy with, you know, jobs and kids and, you know, whatever else, that might be all we have.
We'll dive into some pieces of the book and some of the advice that you offer as the show proceeds. We also want to hear from you out there listening. 513-419-7100 is the number to call. If you have questions or comments, let's go to the phones. First up is Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, how are you today?
We're doing great here. What's your question or comment today?
So my challenge is deer. We have about 2 acres, and we really enjoy gardening. Right now, all my outdoor pots are covered with mesh. And I wondered if you've got a really good, you know, reliable deer repellent, because I feel like I've tried so many. And once the rain comes, we're back to square one.
All right, Kathy, we'll hang up and let the panel discuss. Good luck. So a common problem, deer attacking the beautiful plantings.
I have heard people have varying degrees of success with some of the deer repellents, and I think one of the things that you have to do with them is if you buy one, go ahead and buy several and alternate them, and don't give the deer any kind of consistent smell or repellent. Try to alternate those a good bit. You know, you've got 2 acres. If there's some way you can get to the point where you can fence the most important part of your property, or where your garden is, or your plants, that really does work. And some people in urban areas, they cannot use electric fences because of obviously the neighbors and things like that. But electric fences really are proving to be really good deer deterrents.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join the conversation. Next up is Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Mine is very similar. I've got deer, I've got a fence around my vegetable garden, but that's fine. But I've been using liquid fence, which has, you know, putrefied eggs and a bunch of stuff like that in it, on certain flowers that they really like, and that seems to work. The jar also, or the can also, says you can use it on vegetables. If I spray it on my vegetables, hopefully it works, but is that going to cause the vegetables to taste like the bad smell?
Good question, Bob.
Yeah,
we'll hang up and let the panel address.
Yeah, I don't know for certain. It would certainly make them smell differently. Usually what people do is they apply those materials around the border. So you play it around the edge of the fence or on the soil around the edge of the plant. You don't apply it on the plants itself. But the previous caller mentioned, you know, about rain. Every time it does rain, most of these products you do need to reapply.
So it's a consistent battle.
Yes.
513-419-7100 is the number to call. We're going to take more calls in just a moment. The Gardening Show continues with more advice from our panel of experts and your phone calls and questions just ahead. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with our monthly gardening show. Joining Cincinnati Edition, our 10th acre farm owner and author of The Suburban Micro Farm, Modern Solutions for Busy People, Amy Strauss, director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Home Meadow Song Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Extension agent, David Kester. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join this conversation. Just a point of clarification, 513-419-7100 is the number to join our conversation here, and 513-419-7155 is the number to call to give us money today. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments or your tweets. Talk at WVXU.com. gardeningshow.org will also work as well. You know, it wouldn't be a monthly gardening show if I didn't talk about my disastrous attempt to raise houseplants in my apartment. I live in downtown Covington. I know when you come on, David, you've been here before advising me on what a terrible job I've done. I've killed weeping pussy willow. I've killed some smaller plants. And I've just about completely killed my money tree, my favorite plant that I've had. So I guess my question, just from a personal point of view, somebody who doesn't have a yard to deal with at all, any spaces, when do you need to like change the soil out? When is it time to dump the soil? If it's starting to look bad, what do you do?
Usually you can look at the size of the pot and just see if it's if there's the roots, it's root bound. But one of the things that most people do, if they can move their plants to an outside location at this time of year on a patio or a deck or something like that, this is the time of year that we take a lot of our houseplants, we bring them outside, put them around the deck, and now is when we will repot them, because it's when they get outside, they're just getting a beautiful amount of humidity, sunlight, and just all the rainfall that we're having, and they just start to explode in growth, and they just do so much better outside. And you always want to try to repot them and to fertilize them a little bit right before or during that flush of new growth. So now is a good time to do that. But you really need to look. You don't want to put them in when you move them up to the next size pot. I always made the mistake of, well, you know, I'm going to get this done once and I'll put it in a pot that's two to three times bigger. And that really can be detrimental to it, because all that new soil stays moist too long, and you can kill a plant that way as well.
I think I'm just going to have to go buy some new ones. You know,
that's the other thing. Just go ahead and throw it out and get a new one.
You know, one trick that I found is that our indoor air is so dry. And so what I've started doing is having a spray bottle of water and spraying the foliage of my indoor plants regularly. And that's seemed to help a lot, just to give them, like Dave said, bringing them outside this time of year gives them that humidity. And I think that's something that they're missing indoors.
So just on the leaves themselves, mm-hmm. not necessarily into the soil. Because
that's what
I think I did the first time was I watered too much. That's sort of the inclination for newcomers to just having any plant in the house. Oh, they need water. Here's a full glass every day. And then they drown. So, okay. Well, that's very helpful. Maybe I'll spray it down and see if I can't revive it. All right. 513-419-7100 is the number to call. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Joe on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Doing well. What's your question or comment?
I've got moles for the first time in 36 years. I want to know how to get rid of them. And do moles go after daffodil and tulip bulbs?
No.
All right, Joe, we'll hang up and let the panel answer. He wants to know how to get rid of them and wants to know about daffodils and tulips.
Moles are carnivorous. They're eating earthworms and they're eating grubs in your soil. So we don't want them to eat the earthworms, but the grubs, that'd be okay if we could get rid of those. And as far as controlling them, trapping actually is works better than most people think it does. You'll look at the moles in your lawn and think you have 300 of them out there, when in reality you might just have a couple. So trapping them, getting rid of them that way is actually pretty effective.
We got an email from Jennifer in Mason. She says, I have a problem with wild onions invading my flower beds. How do I eradicate them? They're hard to pull up, she says. Wild onions.
Well, you need to get in. I mean, there's a number of tools that you can use. I mean, like a little hand trowel with forks on it, or those, I don't know what they call. I call them dandelion pullers, but it's a long, narrow shaft with like a little V on the end. And you go down next to it, open the soil, and you have to pull it up, and you need to get that bulb. But at one point, they'll cluster, and there'll be many bulbs. And they are edible, but you can kind of pull those up and thin them out, and it will take a while, but you know, you can do it. But if you keep, that is one thing, like a lot of weeds, you can just hoe and deprive them of photosynthesis and they'll die. The onions, you know, they're much sneakier. They're much harder to get rid of in that way. So you really need to.
You got to get underground.
Yeah, and you got to loosen the soil. And don't do it when the soil is extremely wet. You don't want it like in August when it's baked like a brick. You don't do it then. The soil should be loose and pliable and semi-moist, and that you'll have a lot more luck getting them out.
513-419-7100 is the number. Next up is Audrey. Hi, Audrey.
Hi. Another question around common rodents in your yard. I'm wondering about squirrels specifically. We have a fenced-in garden, and I've noticed that they are more likely to go over the edge and have to constantly chase them out. So do you have any recommendations for how to prevent squirrels from getting to your animal or getting to your plants?
All right, Audrey, appreciate the call. Common Rodents was my band's name in high school, so I appreciate the reminder on that. Okay, what's the advice?
Squirrels are tricky. They get around fencing unless you can completely fence in the, you know, sides and top of your garden. Squirrels are probably going to get in. There are some things that you can do. There's a company that makes organic repellents called I Must Garden, and they make a repellent that's specific for squirrels. And I gave that to my brother. He had really good success with it. But other than that, I know one of the strategies people have mentioned in the past is, you know, in the summer, especially when it's dry out, they really go after our fruiting vegetables, like our tomatoes, because of the moisture. And so setting out, you know, a bird bath or something where they have access to water helps. But I don't know how successful that is. It's not going to be 100% successful.
So what's the real problem that squirrels cause? Because I mean, nature in general terrifies me, but squirrels in particular, because I don't trust any animals that have hands, and they've got these creepy little hands, right? Mm-hmm. And they're always jumping around. But what's the real problem that they cause?
They will dig, and they will they'll eat some fruit occasionally. They're really bad on peaches when the peach trees are ripening. They'll really come in and feast on those, but they're just kind of a nuisance. And honestly, they're very difficult to control because they can jump, they can climb, they can get around. I mean, you know, we've got so many people who have come up with these squirrel-proof bird feeders, and we find out that squirrels are pretty adaptive too, and they can get through those defenses.
They're smart.
Yeah, but they also don't like things they get tangled up in. So you can use over, you know, like a tomato bed or something, you can use what's called the low hoops, and you can put down shade cloth or what they call lightweight rime, and cover those crops when the fruit is coming ripe to keep them off of them. I mean, it's just like with blueberries and birds, you can put bird netting over them. You don't keep them over them all year around. It's just when the fruit is coming ripe, you can do that. But we had a heck of a time with tomatoes at a garden in downtown. Yeah, but I did notice that they don't mess with cherry tomatoes. Or if they do mess with cherry tomatoes, they take the whole cherry tomato, and there's so many of them, you don't miss the loss. Because everybody will say, why do they take one bite out of each tomato? And usually that's like Amy had alluded to, that they're going after water.
Okay, so yeah. They'll damage a whole tomato that you would be able to use, but you can after they've touched it, whereas with the little ones.
Yeah, no, I have seen a squirrel run off with a whole tomato. I do want to say that. I'm not saying they don't, but the cherry tomatoes, they don't. I mean, that is one option, is to choose things that they don't like as much. Like green beans, I've never had a problem with them going after green beans. For instance, they won't dig up a potato.
Ah. Well, they're on the low-carb thing, I suppose.
Yes.
513-419-7100. Carol's up next. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I was wondering if you could say something about whether or not square foot gardening and lasagna gardening, which were big 20 years ago probably when I lived in the city, are still being used, or if they've come up with a better idea.
Okay. Carol, we'll hang up and let the panel discuss. So lasagna gardening or...
You know, I was just thinking about this morning. I think both of those are still really popular, and they can be successful. I mean, a lot of people find success with those. One thing I was thinking about with square foot gardening this morning is that, you know, we live in this river valley. So May, actually, if you look at our rainfall for the year, May is usually rainier than April. And so, you know, that whole April showers brings May flowers is not usually accurate around here. But we have a lot of water. And then throughout the summer, we get a lot of humidity because we're here in the river valley. And, you know, sometimes with the square foot gardening, we can come up with problems related to mildew and fungal issues because our plants are placed too close together. So in a humid environment, sometimes the super close placement of plants isn't beneficial. You might want to spread it out a little bit, especially if you're gardening in partial shade where those plants can't dry out very well. So that's just something I want to throw out there because it's seasonally appropriate.
What is lasagna gardening? I'm assuming that has something to do with layering and not actually growing pasta.
It's also called sheet mulching, but also it relates to no-till techniques also, is where you're building up things, soil in layers. Mm. And so I've done a number of different variations of that. And then Amy's also involved with permaculture, and they have a technique called a hugelkultur, which is also a version of that. And it's still widely practiced and I think is extremely effective, particularly in our area where we have heavy soils. And in particular, if you had an area of your yard that was lawn, you can sheet mulch on top of that or lasagna garden. And what that does is kills the grass. But then the grass decomposes and becomes rich humus and actually feeds the soil. So it's a really low impact, but also less labor.
Back to the phones we go. Next in line is Ted. Hi, Ted.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We're doing great. What's your question or comment today?
Okay, I'm starting to focus on the outside stuff in the yard, but my orchid this week just dropped all of its blooms. Am I killing it?
Oh,
this is my first time with an orchid.
First time with an orchid, wants to know how to keep it alive. Ted, we'll hang up and see what kind of advice our panel comes up with.
It's just dropping the blooms, I think you're okay. It's as long as the foliage is still on there. I'm not an orchid expert, but the one place you might want to go and talk to them about is at Crone Conservatory. They've got a wonderful orchid collection. And they can probably tell you a little bit more about it. But as long as obviously the flower is not going to stay there forever. So if it's only the bloom that's falling and the foliage still looks okay, you're okay.
We got an email from Sherry. She wants to know how much room she needs to plant peas. Is that a lot of space?
Not a lot of space at all. You can grow peas three inches apart, probably 2 inches apart. You could probably plant peas. They don't need a lot of space at all.
How much can that yield? How much do you tend to yield from a, I don't even know, what is it, a pea plant or what?
You
know,
it's a vine.
It's a vine?
Yeah, and you need to, with peas, you need a trellis. So if you have small spaces, you know, peas, and but I do want to say it's a little late to get peas in at this point.
It is.
But you can do half, you know, bush beans, half runner beans, and regular
When do you want to plant peas?
March.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, they like cool weather.
Sherry, that's you don't need a lot of space, but you will have to wait till next March before you work on this pea project.
But you do need to trellis them, and the same thing with beans. A lot of times I may plant them, 3 inches apart, but then after I figure with the strongest plants, I remove every other one, at least, and then let them grow, and then you can use any number of techniques for trellising them. And
she also offered a follow-up question that's unrelated, but she wants to know how to get rid of bamboo. And I think we get this question pretty frequently. It seems to be a problem for people.
Yeah, because I guess you would consider it at the rhizome that runs under. You just have to really dig and just remove everything, and then what you want to do is leave the area open because you're going to have to go back in again.
It's so strange. Yeah. People are always calling, trying to get rid of bamboo, and yet like Pier 1 can sell it to me for like an arm and a leg. Yeah. Very strange. 513-419-7100 is the next number to call. If you'd like to get your question or comment in, let's go to Barb. She's next in line. Hi, Barb.
Yes, I discovered Turner Farmer about 4 years ago, and I love going there and buying the fresh produce 6 days a week. I'm hearing that Turner has received some things. And I guess my suggestion is that not only that we spread the word on fresh produce, but also on cooking it. So I have taken some cooking classes there and have taken some friends, but the cost is so prohibitive. And in view of getting public grants and things like that, I mean, I'm talking about $65, $75, $85, $95 a person. And I'm just wondering if in the future, you could have more cooking classes so we could, bring our children. And I know there are some classes that are in the 20s, but most of them are $55 and up. And I think that perpetuates a kind of a elite flavor to Turner Farms, which is located in Indian Hill. So,
all right, Barb,
we
appreciate the call and the comment very much. And we'll hang up and
I'd like to say
Peter
to that is that that's you know, we get that feedback. And the culinary program is different, and the health and wellness program is a different program than the CSA vegetable market and also the community garden program. The classes that take place in the community garden programs, which are the outreach program, are free. And so if you contact me, peter@turnerfarm.org, I'll put you on our mailing list. And we do an annual health and wellness and cooking class with Chef Stephanie once a year. But we also have these kind of pop-up events in the gardens that involve cooking fresh food on-site in the garden, which deals with a number of different things too. So excellent comment, and feel free to contact me for our free programming.
And we've got the Turner contact information in the Cincinnati Edition section on WVXU.org. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What's causing you trouble this season in your garden or your landscape? The Gardening Show continues now with 10th Acre Farm owner and author of The Suburban Micro Farm, Modern Solutions for Busy People, Amy Strauss. Director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Home Meadow Song Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Extension Agent, David Kester. 513-419-7100 is the number to call. We've got a lot of people waiting on the line, so let's go right back to the phones. We've got Mark up next. Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
What's your question or comment?
I have a comment. It's just a suggestion for the folks who have deer problems. I live in Clifton, and believe it or not, we have a fair share of deer that treat your backyard as their salad bar. But my neighbor, what he does is he uses fishing lines between set points to fence his garden, and you can't really see the line, so it's not an eyesore. But at the same time, once a deer approaches his vegetables, they get spooked because they feel something and they don't see it. So it helps, and it actually works better than the other remedies. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Mark. Fishing line, is that harmful to the deer at all? I mean, can it be tight enough to where it hurts, or is it just, like he said, it's just something that they feel and then they run off?
Yeah, they get spooked easy. I've also used lightweight wire to extend the height of a fence, because then it looks like a regular height fence, but it's invisible, but the deer can sense it. I've also heard that wind blowing over the material makes they can hear it, and that's a distract that also kind of spooks them. I don't know if I've never heard any, seen any research on that specifically, so maybe it's sort of like a cultural story. But I know a number of people that do that, and it can be effective.
Yeah, you've got the deer no matter what part of town you're in. There's some deer that love life in the city.
You know, but I just think in general about animals. I mean, remember is that, you know, they have just as much of a right to be here as possible. And I certainly will go after, with a vengeance, groundhogs but and different animals. But also be mindful, if you have an area that's heavily populated and there's a lot of problems, you know, think about maybe putting your things that you want to protect in another area where they're less apt to go into. Think about the natural patterns that they move through. So by learning something about their behaviors and what they were trying to accomplish can help you come up with strategies to trick them or work around them or coexist with them.
Deer like Indian food and independent movies just like the rest of us. And
that's
Clifton's a fine neighborhood for that sort of thing. Let's go to Mary now. Hi, Mary. How are you? Is Mary there?
Yes, I am.
All right, Mary. What's your question or comment?
Well, I have a paverlock patio, and the weeds grow up profusely. And what has happened, I recently bought a tool I thought would work, and it did not. And so I returned that, and I'm wondering, is there a tool that can actually, I had this vision of a thing where you might be able to, you know, stand up and it you can squeeze it and it'll pull out the weeds, but I think I might have made that up. But is there any such tool that would work that way?
All right. So you've got weeds growing up between the blocks on your patio.
That's correct.
Okay. And we'll hang up and let the panel address that. Thanks, Mary. Yeah. Okay, so is this something where she's going to need a spray, or what is she going to do?
There are some sprays that she could use in that situation. One of the things that you might want to try and call a commercial landscape maintenance company, because they deal with these kind of things, and they will actually kind of work, find tools that will do that job in a hurry, and they will adapt things, and they can sometimes give you some keys to being able to accomplish that in a really quick order, and a tool that really works. I mean, obviously, it's got to be thin, but it's got to be pretty durable to get down in between there. And you also have to be kind of careful about removing a lot of the sand that's in between those blocks, because it, you know, can destabilize it a little bit. So, but there are sprays that you can use, obviously, to kill the weeds out of there. And, you know, not going to contaminate anything, any vegetation, if you just keep it on your, in the paving areas.
Yeah. And also there's a, if you contact me through the website at WVXU, I can give you a remedy, a herbicide that's made out of vinegar, Epsom salts, and a little bit of dish detergent. So it's very inert. You don't have to worry about it. And that can help. But there's also a tool called Flamer that's used in agriculture. And the agricultural ones are pretty large, and they work off the large, like, 5-gallon propane tanks. But there's a small version of it that's made for just that purpose. And what it does, it shoots out a flame, and you just singe the top of the plant in between the bricks. Hmm. And so it doesn't burn the brick or anything. But the trick is people want to stand there until they have a pile of ash. But you just pass it over, and it just causes the, and then you come back 2 or 3 days later. And that's very effective. I noticed when I was visiting my brother in Florida recently, like, all the people that lived in his little suburban area all had those out on their little brick driveways up there, getting crabgrass out of it. But it's fairly effective.
All right. Next up is Anne. Let's go to Anne. Hi, Anne.
Yes. We have chipmunks in our yard, and I was wondering, are they considered a nuisance pest? And if so, what should we do about them?
All right. Chipmunks, Anne, we'll hang up and let the panel discuss. Chipmunks, good, bad? Should she get rid of them? It's some serious deliberation going on in this room.
I'm not sure. They used to be a protected species, and I'm not sure that you can just indiscriminately go out there and kill them. There are ways to do it, of course, but I'm not really sure whether I'd have to check and make sure that that's still that you're able to do that.
Yeah. One of the problems with chipmunks, they do root around in things, and they can destabilize dry stacked stones and things like that. But, you know, it's interesting that she mentions that I've seen them in Spring Grove Cemetery, but we don't have them at our house across the street on Gray Road, and we don't really have that problem. Where I've heard about people having, they live further out of town in big properties surrounded by woodlots.
Again, please check this, but you can get a rat trap and bait it with peanut butter and corn, and that is pretty effective. And also a cat works really well if you can tolerate that. And out where I live, we don't have too much of a problem because we have some really light, nice, large black rat snakes who love to go down and probe the holes that they've dug, and they'll come out with a chipmunk.
Sometimes nature takes care of itself. All right, I think we're going to be getting into the lightning round here in our final several minutes that we have on the show. We want to see if we can get through some of these calls. We've got Charlie on the line. Hey, Charlie.
Hi there.
What's your question today?
I have a question for the panel.
All right.
About 5 years ago, I planted cherry trees, and they grew. They're growing wildly, but every summer, no matter how much I spray, they get their leaves turn brown and fall off by early August. Just curious if you have I think it's a cypress rot or some sort of mold.
And which part of town are you in?
Hyde Park.
Okay, cool. Charlie, we'll hang up and let the panel discuss.
Wait, if they're sweet cherries.
Right.
Well, Dave, let Dave's.
Are these fruit-bearing trees that you actually want to eat the fruit from? Oh, he's gone?
They haven't yet.
Okay. But
I don't know if I missed the crossover, germinating.
Okay, what are you spraying with?
It's basically just a powder that you mix with water and spray.
Okay.
It's supposed to kill mold.
Yeah. You're probably going to have to do more than that to get cherries off of them. And if you would call one of the extension offices, we can I'll send you a publication on a spray schedule, and I'll have organic methods as well as synthetic chemical methods, and you can keep those cherries on there. The biggest problem with cherry trees is when they start to ripen, every bird from miles around is going to come and try to harvest them for you, and you've got to net them when they are getting close to being ripe.
All right, Charlie, check out WVXU.org. Click on programs. You'll find Cincinnati Edition there. You'll see the link to today's show, and that's where you'll find David's contact info for him to send you that stuff. Yeah. Thanks so much for the call.
And as a quick rule of thumb, pie cherries or tart cherries do a lot better in this climate than like Bing and the sweet cherries. And so most of the extension agencies will say don't even grow sweet cherries. So that's just another thing to think.
You know, another thing that I was thinking about with the netting of the cherries, I had the tart cherries planted in my yard, my previous yard, and I noticed that nearby I had black raspberries growing, and that was sort of like a trap crop because they preferred the black raspberries over the cherries, which fruit at the same time. So trap crops can help you not need to net as much.
I have been in this area for many, many years, and on two different occasions we have had, I've been here for the 17-year cicada outbreak, and on both those times that they were out and prevalent, people told me that was the only year that they got cherries because the birds were so busy eating cicadas that they left their cherry crop alone.
So the cicadas taste better than the cherries.
I guess they do.
Interesting. Well, I guess they're more of a novelty. All right, next up we've got Jackie. Hi, Jackie. Is Jackie on the line? All right, we'll try to come back to Jackie. We'll check out, we've got Jim up next. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
How are you? What's your question?
Well, I live in Covedale, and we live in a house that has a really nice Rosa Sharon on one side, and it's been popping up volunteers on the other side. And I need to know how I can get rid of the volunteers without hurting the original bush.
I think you can just sever those with a sharp spade, and if you want to, you can probably get some root with them and plant them somewhere else, or just go ahead and sever them. That Rosa Sharon is pretty tough, and they will do that, but I don't think you're going to hurt the mother plant, or if those are seedlings from it, they're going to be on their own root system anyway, so you're not going to hurt them.
Yeah, and if you cut like at least 18 inches away from the main stock of the plant you're trying to save, you know, you're not going to hurt it, but you got to get the roots out.
There you go, Jim. Thanks for the call. And let's go back and try Jackie again. Hi, Jackie, are you there? I'm going to guess that we're just having some technical difficulties with Jackie, and maybe she'll call back next month. So, Amy, one question we got via email is, when you talk about small spaces, what are, say, the best vegetables to grow in containers on a patio or a deck, especially for those of us who might be trying that for the first time?
Oh, yeah. Container gardening. That's a fun place to start. Some of my favorites are cherry tomatoes. I think those do really well in containers. I like to do things that go well in salads, like lettuce, beets, what else? Herbs do really well in containers.
All easier for first timers before you get into the complicated things like the peas where you need the vine and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, we got some emailed questions as well. Oh, actually a comment from Zita who commented on the wild onions that we talked about earlier, and you had referenced how the ground shouldn't be soaked. It also shouldn't be baked. So somewhere in the middle there is where you want to find it. She says that if you pull wild onions straight up when the ground is wet, they are easy to get rid of. So it sounds like you've got a second to that motion as well. John called and left a message and says that human hair in a nylon bag, hang it around your garden, that keeps deer away. That might keep neighbors away, too, actually, if you saw a bag of hair hanging by the garden.
I have heard that, and it's also like a bag of Irish Spring soap. But all these things, like Dave mentioned earlier, you usually have to use them in some kind of rotation. Yeah. Animal hair also.
When we talk about container gardening, what do you think about the material that's used to construct the container? Do you think clay or plastic? Is there a container type that's best?
No, not really. I think that our containers are, they can be pretty adaptable to whatever your situation is. Now, I would consider if you are thinking about at the end of the season needing to move those pots, you're probably going to want to go with something like plastic that's a little bit lighter to carry. Those clay pots, especially when full, can be pretty heavy.
And we got an email from Anne who wants to know if you can compost without a bin. Can she just toss vegetable waste onto the garden bed?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, that's a really easy way to do it. It's sometimes I think we make composting more technical than it really has to be. And just putting leaves on top of your garden and maybe putting some soil on top of that is gonna work. It's gonna be slower, but it'll work just fine.
But if you're talking about kitchen straps, there is a little bit more maintenance about that. I mean, it's as opposed to like what we call yard waste or yard trimmings. So vegetable waste, and you want to make sure there's no protein in it, no dairy, heavy oils and things like that. And that should be mixed with what they call carbon or dried leaves or straw or different things and kind of kept in a more orderly area. But it doesn't have to be in a physical container. It could be what's called a windrow. And you could make a windrow, could be mini, or it could be 150 feet long.
And that doesn't attract any pest, or does it attract?
No, it
pests?
Really doesn't if you don't have the meat and the eggs and stuff. It's just pure vegetable.
All right. Well, that's the gardening show.
No dairy.
For this month. We'll have you back next month as well, or a panel of gardening experts next month, and we'll see if I don't have some better success with some houseplants that I can't wait to tell you all about. Our thanks today to 10th Acre Farm owner and author of The Suburban Micro Farm, Modern Solutions for Busy People, Amy Strauss, director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program, and co-overseer of Home Meadow Song Farm, Peter Huttinger, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Extension Agent, David Kester. Thanks to all of you for being here. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, archives at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.